Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
We're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spot. I'm Matty Robbins.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, Capone from Ain't It Cool News stops by to help us count down our top five performances of the year so far.
Plus listener feedback, Massacre Theater, and music by Utah Carol.
But first, we're going to tackle, or begin to tackle, the burning bat question on everyone's bat mind. Matty, why so serious?
Where do we begin?
A year ago, these cops and lawyers wouldn't dare cross any of you. I mean, what happened?
So what are you proposing?
It's simple. Kill the Batman. Here's my card.
People everywhere in film spotting land may be surprised to learn that my co-host, their intrepid champion of all things filmic, art house Adam Kempinar, has an aversion, a strong aversion, to long film.
Slander.
In fact, Adam, what I forgot. What did you think about Omar Sharif's performance in Lawrence of Arabia?
It's really one of the best of all time.
Right. Mr. Kempinar's time is money. I bring this up because Christopher Nolan's latest Batman entry, The Dark Knight, has a running time of 2.5 hours, 2 hours and 32 minutes. And it's not filled with subtle, languid meditations on a theme. It is chock full of plot. Towards the end of The Dark Knight, I would offer there are probably 4 or 5 plot lines that could probably command movies themselves. And about the time you think, my God, they cannot possibly support all these storylines, bam, Zeus, the former World Wrestling Federation wrestler, shows up with a complete character arc all his own. And we've got another 30 minutes to go. And before you write in, that is not a spoiler, actually, trust me. And this actually might be a good time to add that in an unprecedented move, we are going to be reviewing this movie, The Dark Knight, not once, but twice.
Yes.
Next week, we're bringing in Entertainment Weekly's sexiest film critic from 2006, Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. He'll be joining us for a spoiler review. A spoiler review of The Dark Knight, which is, of course, due in part to the fact that there is a lot going on in this film. So at the end of this long, long David Lean epic-type movie, Adam, we're also proud that you pulled through it. Were you exhilarated or were you exhausted?
Well, I was both exhilarated and exhausted, which I'm sure just by admitting that, it's probably going to be enough to earn the wrath of all the fanboys everywhere who are listening and have already crowned this movie a masterpiece, the Citizen Kane of comic book films. We've already received a few of these emails. And you know what? It just might be the Citizen Kane of comic book movies, but it did wear me out. I love that we are going to have that spoiler edition next week where we can really get in and dissect it and allow this to be just more of a cursory review. But there was a point at about the hour 45-minute mark where I thought the movie was over, and it was beautiful. It was a perfect Empire Strikes Back place to end the film and set up the next installment and leave it on a really dark note. And exhilarated is exactly how I felt. That's a perfect way to describe it because I get that feeling when I'm watching movies and everything comes together. Things fall perfectly into place on screen. You can have that oh my God experience, and I had it here. I mean, Christian Bale, Gary Oldman, Aaron Eckhart, Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, Maggie Gyllenhaal, and of course Heath Ledger, who I'm sure we're going to get to in a minute, they're all great. And the early action scenes, especially in IMAX, which is how we saw it, they're breathtaking. The depiction of Gotham City has an epic feel to it. It's like what Michael Mann did with a movie I love and you not so much Heat. There's just a sweeping feel to this movie and a gritty authenticity that I haven't seen from a comic book film. And I really could waste everyone's time talking about all the cool scenes in this movie. But you get to that point, that great hour and 45-minute ending that I thought was the end, and there's 45 minutes left. And contrary to what you said, Matty, I don't have a problem with long films at all. The Godfather's 3 hours long, so is The Godfather 2, I believe. And I even loved all 167 minutes of scenes from A Marriage. I just don't get excited about watching long movies. The problem with The Dark Knight isn't that it's 2.5 hours long. It's what you said. I do feel like Nolan tried to pack at least two more movies into 45 minutes, and by the end of it, my head was spinning a bit. The transformation of one of the major characters is handled, for me, in a really hurried comic book kind of way.
I think we'll talk about that
next
week.
We will. We're just asked to accept something as inevitable rather than actually see it unfold and really feel the weight of the tragedy of that transformation. I think he's going for that. I didn't feel it. And just as with Batman Begins, I thought the big action finale was unnecessarily chaotic and hard to follow. So for me, the bottom line here, this movie was exhilarating for a large part of the film, and I can't wait to be exhilarated by it all over again, but I also look forward to watching it again so I can see if I can reconcile some of those things that exhausted me about it. How did you come out?
Well, I have to say, you know, Kevin Smith wrote on his blog that he considers this film the Godfather 2 of comic book films. And I think he's right. It is an epic. But I think a more apt comparison would actually be with Gone with the Wind, because at its heart, and the story that I went with, is the love triangle between Bruce Wayne, Rachel Dawes, and Harvey Dent. And I think one of the most suspenseful scenes for me wasn't these great action scenes, which we could sit here and coo and caw about how great they are, and I would recommend that you see this film in IMAX. 20 minutes of filming done on IMAX cameras. Wally Pfister does an amazing job here, and Chicago never, ever looks so good. If we ever go back and do our top five Chicago films, this one has to be up there, even though it's Gotham City.
Well, though, I'm not sure I'd want to live in this Chicago.
You're right.
In terms of the bigness of it,
I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, we're dealing with our own problems right now, and I actually could empathize with a lot of what these people are going through. Of course, they're taking it to the next level here. But it was that love triangle that I really thought was the heart of this film. And one of the most suspenseful scenes for me was the awkward dinner scene shared by the three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Suspenseful because you don't know how Bruce Wayne is going to react. He doesn't know what to make of Harvey Dent, who I think is played beautifully here by Aaron Eckhart.
He is.
And really, the audience doesn't really know what to make of him either. Does he endorse him? What's he going to say? And it's gripping, and it's soap operatic, and it plays, and this is not a backhanded compliment, it plays like one of those great television crime dramas, NYPD Blue, Hill Street Blues, West Wing. Every single character, no matter how small their supporting role, plays a huge role in this film. And you've got Morgan Freeman as Lucius, Michael Caine as Alfred, all these scores of characters, their plot lines get introduced about three quarters of the way into this film, and they're fleshed out completely, but you're absolutely right. Is he almost inundating us with too much at that point? But I did have to champion the fact that, wow, here we go. I can't believe that he is bringing all this stuff to the table, and I was pretty riveted.
Yeah, I was too, and I can't wait to see the next one, which is also always the good sign at one of these films. When you get to the end of it, are you still curious to see where this film's going to go? There are a lot of open ends when you get to the end of this movie, without a doubt, and there's a lot of new interesting directions they can go in. I do kind of wish that the last 45 minutes of the film was that next installment.
Yeah.
And we really could have seen the Harvey Dent story even more explored instead of it feeling to me a little bit like it was tacked on and really rushed through to get all these things set up for the next movie. Because like I said, there was a point where I thought the movie was going to end and I was about ready to jump up and applaud. But I do love the love triangle as well. I think that Aaron Eckhart is fantastic. And like I said, all those supporting roles are really good. I guess the big question we got to get to here, and we are going to cut this a little bit short this week. We got a big top five segment with our performances of the year so far, and we are going to discuss this movie more in depth next week. But Heath Ledger, where do you come down, Matty?
I think he's terrific. I really think he's phenomenal. He is the bomb. Quite literally, he is a bomb when he's on the screen. Bombs don't have agendas. The people that plant bombs have agendas. And there are so many people here that dare to use him. He is evil incarnate, and he's just having so much fun with this role. You can't help but smile and also at the same time be on the edge of your seat every single scene that he's in. What is he going to do? And I guess he had a great time filming this as well. I remember the stories that he would ride his skateboard around downtown Chicago in full makeup, making this. And you can see that. That comes through. He's having a great time, but he is the bomb. He is evil. We know what his motivation is. It's just to wreak havoc. I actually have to say I was more into Aaron Eckhart as Harvey Dent and his story because he changes. He actually moves throughout the film.
Yeah.
And the Joker does start to monologue by the end of the film.
Yep.
And that's when people start to sort of, it gets into this question of moral character, what makes a man, and of course the Dark Knight always questioning who he is. But it's interesting who gets lost in this film. For me, it's Christian Bale. Because if you go back and remember Batman Returns, returns. Michael Keaton basically plays fifth chair in that film to Christopher Walken, Michelle Pfeiffer, the Batmobile, you know, itself, yeah. Danny DeVito. Here we get to see Bruce Wayne's internal struggle play out in all these other characters around him. And I think that's great. To this film's credit, every character around him exhibits sort of a different shade of morality and integrity. And Gotham City itself, like Bruce Wayne, is this city where its collective personality is seething with contradictions, you know, sort of continually questioning its own identity.
Yeah.
And I think that's what was even more interesting than, of course, Mr. Ledger's brilliant performance. But what did you think? As I completely digressed there.
Well, I liked him a lot, too. And as you know, a while back on the show when this first came up, I earned some scorn from listeners because I doubted Heath Ledger in this role. My take on him is that he's not a quote-unquote actor, which is fine, but he's just not a larger-than-life performer. In Brokeback Mountain, for example, and I may have already said this on a past show, but he plays a character who has a hard time talking and expressing his emotion. So the way Ledger chose to play that was to literally talk through clenched teeth. That's something, you know, a method actor, I think, maybe would have, someone else may have internalized that, would have behaved as though they were acting through clenched teeth. Well, he literally has to act through clenched teeth.
You're right. And of course, the irony is that Ledger is a method actor. And I purportedly for a month, he actually lived his life as the Joker in an apartment, sort of working on all these physicalizations. And you're right. And you see that here. Here it comes with this lip smacking that he introduces.
Yes.
And you're right. It's like, okay, we get it. You know, it's that character. It's that, but that's that hamminess fun that it is there in this movie.
No, I agree.
You know, this movie isn't all, yes, this movie's dark, but at the same time, remember those first 7 minutes. It's great. It's a gripping sort of crime drama.
Yes, it is.
But at the same time, remember the voices of the gang that is actually robbing the bank? They talk like, you know, they talk like regular comic book villains.
They do.
You know? And I think that's to Nolan's credit. He's saying, look, this is still a comic book film. Hmm. You can still have fun here. And that's what I saw in Ledger's performance.
Well, that's maybe an interesting point to get into next week, because I do wonder if he made it so authentic and so real and so of this time. It felt to me not at all like, you know, Tim Burton and the comic book mm-hmm. feel to those movies, and yet we do still get a lot of those comic book things, including the transformation, as I said, of one of the main characters. So I had a hard time reconciling that a little bit. But what I'm saying about Ledger is that was my perception coming in about him, is that he's just not very imaginative. He's not theatrical. And I saw the Joker as a character calling for that theatricality. But the fact is, he really burrowed into this role, and he made him terrifying and real. And even with that lip smacking and the makeup, I didn't see him as a comic book villain. I bought Gotham City as a real city here, and I bought him as a real terrorist. You talk about him being a bomb, that's a better way to put it, but someone who literally just enjoys terrorizing.
Yes.
And we can get in next week to really what he's trying to bring out or say about society and civility and all that stuff, because I do think that Nolan is trying to explore that stuff a little bit, but he pulls it off. He is great fun to watch. He made me love watching a serial killer, just like another movie from last year, No Country for Old Men, and we will talk about that next week as well. So anyway, we are both fans of this film. I look forward to seeing it again, though, and like I said, wrestling with some of my demons as I watch the movie and getting feedback as well, and Michael Phillips is going to join us. It's going to be a lot of fun next week. We may even bring in another guest next week. So The Dark Knight, of course, is out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it, and we know you're going to, and you agree or disagree with our takes, you can send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. Of course, you can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right. Well, I'm exhausted. I'm completely spent. Time for a quick break. I think we all need it. At the time, I wore a night retainer, and with its metal prongs and pink middle portion, it strangely resembled the version of the alien that would drop the egg into its victim's mouth while I slept. I refused to wear it and hid it in a shoebox in my closet until I was 14 years old. Adam and I dust off the Film Spotting therapy couch next in listener feedback. Stay with us.
Inside your world. Hey, Maddie Adam, it's Todd from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Just calling in. I just listened to your Hellboy episode, and I have to say, I dug Hellboy an awful lot. I thought it was really good, a lot better than the first one, even though I still enjoyed the first one. I know a lot of people didn't. I thought it was hilarious. The little sing-along between Hellboy and Abe was fantastic. I think Hellboy is one of the better movies of the summer so far. I don't know if that's going to be true next week, because I think Dark Knight might blow everything away ever.
Hey, my name is Matt, and I listen from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm a big movie geek like you guys, but at the same time, I'm a huge comic book geek. Maybe if I could disconnect myself from the background of the comic books, from the point of view of the comics, I could enjoy Hellboy more. But honestly, the bad script, the really poor jokes, and the love story between him and Liz just kills it for me. Absolutely kills it. The last thing I wanted to see in this movie was more of that love story. That was the only thing that bothered me about the first movie.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and a little point counterpoint there. Some responses on Hellboy 2, our review from last week. Todd really liked the movie. Matt in Omaha, not so much. And it was interesting what he said, Maddie, because he talked about how he's a huge fan of the comic. And it is sometimes true that you bring that baggage to a movie like this. You see things that the two of us who aren't familiar with the comic aren't going to see, and we're maybe going to enjoy more than he did. But I'm with him, actually, that I didn't like the love story so much between Hellboy and Selma Blair's character, Liz. I didn't find it all that interesting, and I found it pretty hokey, actually. So I'm with him there.
I actually anticipated, you know, that argument coming from, you know, comic book fans, and there's no way I can rebut it. Mm-hmm. I actually agree. I thought the script was pretty tame. I thought it was really soft. As a family film, it works, but there's no guts. There's no grit there at all. I mean,
no.
It's Candyland stuff.
Yeah, it really is. So maybe not something you expect from the director of Pan's Labyrinth, but there it is.
And Blade 2, right?
And Blade 2. Very good, Maddie.
Maybe you expect that from the guy that directed Blade 2.
Maybe so. You're showing your fanboy cred there a little bit, your street cred. I like it.
I get out.
Yeah. We're going to get to a few more thoughts on Hellboy 2 here in a minute, as well as some top five feedback. But first, we do want to share our poll question, starting with last week's question, very appropriate, tying in with our review of The Dark Knight. We asked you why you are most excited to see The Dark Knight. Is it because of Christian Bale's performance, Christopher Nolan's direction, Heath Ledger's performance, or I'm not excited, Batman sucks? Maybe no surprises here, Maddie.
Number one, 51%, Mr. Ledger's performance. Christopher Nolan coming in second, 37%. Christian Bale, 8%. Not excited, Batman sucks, only 4%.
I'm still a little bit surprised at 4%, but that's fine. I understand there may be some haters out there. This week's poll question, you can vote at filmspotting.net. This summer seems to be, anyway, a good summer for comedies. We got a few coming out that we're very excited about, including the first one here in our poll question, Hamlet 2, and we're very excited to say that right now it does look like one Mr. Steve Coogan is going to be in studio here with us at some point. We're going to be able to have him on the show for an interview. I'm definitely looking forward to that, but we want to know which summer comedy you're most excited to see.
Is it Mr. Coogan in Hamlet 2, Pineapple Express, Step Brothers, or Tropic Thunder?
This is actually a tough one for me to answer, Maddie. Where do you come out?
I got to go with Tropic Thunder.
Yeah?
It's either going to be a train wreck or mesmerizing.
Yeah, it could be. And that's the one I'm trying to decide between, Tropic Thunder, because I've seen the trailer and it does look pretty hilarious. And I've heard good things about Robert Downey Jr.'s performance in it, and it could be great. But then Pineapple Express as well. You got Rogan, you got James Franco, and David Gordon Green making one of these films. I'm just dying to see what that one's going to be like. I like the other comedies, too. I'm curious about Adam McKay and Step Brothers and, of course, Steve Coogan and Hamlet, too. So some good comedies coming out. Let us know which one you're most excited about at filmspotting.net. Why don't we share some more responses on Hellboy here, Maddie? It turns out that a few people did get out to see it last weekend, like Mike in Buffalo.
He writes in, I enjoyed your review of Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, but I think overall you were too kind to this film. Unlike Pan's Labyrinth, Del Toro's latest film was the odd movie that feels constantly rushed while at the same time sluggish in its pacing towards the finale. And while I appreciated the main acting, Perlman and McFarlane were consistently entertaining, I expected better work from Del Toro. An Art Voice review noted that Hellboy 2 was one of Del Toro's quote-unquote populist movies, in contrast to his more artistic films, but I don't see that as an excuse for the hurried and offsetting pace of this film. The populist deserves their films well-paced, too. Christopher Nolan and Jon Favreau understand that. I don't know if Mr. Favreau does. I hope Del Toro veers more towards Labyrinth and away from Hellboy structuring when he puts together The Hobbit.
And I assume he means Pan's Labyrinth, of course, and not Labyrinth.
The Power of the Babe.
Yes, but some interesting thoughts from Mike Reif again in Buffalo, New York. And it's funny, he mentions the pacing. I can't say I really noticed the pacing of this film ever being a problem. And at the end, rather than being sluggish, I'd actually say it was maybe too fast. It kind of, the action scenes were glossed over a little bit, but I thought it was pretty well paced, Maddie.
Oh, you can't slow down and linger on that script.
No.
I'm sorry, we're going to see right through that.
That's a good point. This one from Jessica Severson, or Severson, in Atlanta, Georgia. I was glad you guys liked Hellboy 2. I liked it, though I do think Del Toro should get matched up with a stronger writer. There you have it. After leaving the show, my husband immediately started complaining. The plot was predictable. The love story was lame. The beginning was the best, and then it went steadily downhill. I looked at him and said, how many superhero movies have we seen this summer?
A lot.
Was a single one of them anything but predictable?
They were all predictable.
Did any of them have a decent love story?
No.
Did any of them end on a high point?
No.
I told him that he should go easy on Hellboy. The only reason I think he was so hard on it was because the direction and the visuals were so much stronger than the other movies we've seen that he raised his expectations for the rest of the movie to follow suit. As for me, I felt that at least it brought to the table what was missing from Iron Man. Fun stuff to look at and cool fight sequences. While Iron Man may be more enjoyable overall, I think Hellboy shows you just what Iron Man was lacking in direction and imagination.
Well, I think Iron Man was lacking in imagination. I think I said that, but I thought it was chock full of cool fight sequences and cool stuff to look at. In fact, that's what I thought it boiled down to in the end. So here, yeah, here's a lot of cool stuff, but kind of fun mythology to go along with it. Again, neither film really that deep, and that's fine. I had a good time at both films.
Well, and I would just add that in terms of a decent love story, I think Iron Man has a decent love story. I don't know that it's great or, you know, it's something brilliant for cinema, but I did really like the Gwyneth Paltrow, Tony Stark thing with Robert Downey Jr. So that worked for me. I would say that had a decent love story.
It's planting the seeds for something. I mean, it's going to get there.
He has the same head.
What?
The same head.
No. Mine's different.
Oh, no. It's the same head.
Mine's different, man.
This is different. Yeah.
Look, mine's the newest, latest. Mine's fresh.
No, the ear thing's here. The same.
Yeah. No, man. Look, mine is the hype.
A clip from a movie there, Maddie, I absolutely adore, and it's the subject of our next email as we transition into feedback on our top five movies to teach an alien about Earth. We shared some of these last week on the show, and it's actually in conjunction with something we did with Spout.com. You can actually read a lot of entries from a lot of our listeners over there at filmgaming.spout.com. I certainly encourage you to do so. But Tom Clark here in San Jose, California, reminded me of a movie I really feel guilty about leaving off.
The first film to pop into my mind was Jim Jarmusch's Night on Earth. One of the strongest reasons to include it is that it takes place around the world, showing that although there are disparate cultures on the planet, we are all connected through common traits like humor, compassion, anger, etc. Just wondering if either of you considered it for your list.
Well, I did not consider it for my list because I completely forgot about it. And it's actually my favorite Jarmusch film, which may be blasphemy a little bit. I know there are a lot of guys out there, a lot of movie fans who love many of his films, and I do too, but it's actually my favorite. And it would have perfectly fit on my list, Maddie, because again, I talked about movies I wanted to kind of be universal and about the human experience, and I had Amores Perros as my number five, and I even said that Babel would have been a better choice in terms of fitting my criterion, except that I don't like the movie. Well, this one's perfect. It takes place around the world, Helsinki, and I think New York. I can't remember all the cities. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I really do like the movie Night on Earth, and it would have been on my list. I think it would have bumped out Amores Perros, so Tom, well done.
Really?
Yeah.
Amores Perros is off.
Yeah,
let's go back. Let's go back.
You want
to revise it? Yeah.
Re-record that?
Yeah.
We could. This one from David in Bloomington, Indiana. I love the show, but I've never been as motivated to write in as I was after your top five movies to teach an alien about Earth. Great idea, great list. And while there are a million movies that could have made the cut, I felt the need to speak up for one I think particularly well-suited. Amadeus. Tom Hulce's buffoonish Mozart shows that even though we humans might seem intolerable at times from the outside, we are capable of generating great, sublime things from within. Abraham Salieri shows that the sublime, Mozart's music, is capable of overpowering all the negative feelings we can also inspire, in his case, hatred and envy. Add in the fact that you are also introducing the alien to some of mankind's most profound music, and I can't think of a more suitable pick.
I think it's a great pick.
It is.
You know,
well stated.
Exactly. And it also shows that most of us are going to wallow in mediocrity. There's always going to be someone that's better than you.
Exactly. And I could relate to Salieri way more than I wanted to. I'll say that. I definitely could there. So great stuff.
Every time you come into the studio, right?
Exactly.
It just eats away at you.
I'm looking across the board here.
I know. I can see it behind your eyes.
Sometimes I actually do think about that, Maddie. But great stuff there from all of our listeners. And again, that was a really fun topic to get into. Encourage you to check out some more responses over at Spout, filmgaming.spout.com. And we're going to close this segment here with a response to last week's top five, our top five creatures, a really good one here from Vanessa.
First time, long time, writing in from Sacramento, California. I felt compelled to write in response to your top five movie creatures. The alien from Alien is perhaps the most awful thing I've ever seen committed to film. As an impressionable 11-year-old, my ill-advised father decided to take his two girls to see Alien at the Revival movie house at our local Air Force base. I sat shaking with fear as this vision of evil washed over me. We left the theater quiet and freaked out, to go home and stare at each other until bedtime arrived. At the time, I wore a night retainer, and with its metal prongs and pink middle portion, it strangely resembled the version of the alien that would drop the egg into its victim's mouth while they slept. I refused to wear it and hid it in a shoebox in my closet until I was 14 years old. I ask you, was 2 hours of freakout worth hundreds of dollars in dentistry? Did my father learn nothing from what I call the summer of the Exorcist? A great choice from both of you, but my teeth have never been the same.
Oh, poor Vanessa. That is Vanessa Bedford in Sacramento, California. We appreciate the email. Alien was our joint number one choice there, and I think she said it perfectly. I can't wait till next week's show where we get to read some of the great nightmares that people had to Wizard of Oz. That's on next week's show.
No, exactly. Or my sister, who basically slept on my parents' floor for 2 months after seeing those gremlins.
I can see that. I can definitely see that happening. Well, as always, again, we appreciate the great feedback. You can send any other comments or suggestions you have to feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, we'll share some more of your top five movie creatures and, of course, reactions to The Dark Knight. And we'll feature even more of your great feedback in our podcast-only After Hours edition. That comes out next week as well if you want to check it out.
Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater. And we begin our search for this year's Ellen Page with our top five female performances of the year so far. Stay with us.
Now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. And Maddie, it's another week of light trading here. In terms of new releases, 21 is finally out, the movie about the MIT blackjack players.
21 is finally out.
Yeah, exactly. Kate Bosworth, I was trying to be nice there, I guess. And Jim Sturgis from Across the Universe, I believe, in that film. And also, of course, Kevin Spacey. And that trailer just looked awful to me, so we chose not to see it or review it. But it is out now, and it includes an audio commentary with the filmmakers. I know you're going to rush right home, aren't you?
Well, I actually am going to check it out. As I think some people probably realized I do have a penchant for, you know, gambling of sorts. And So I do want to check it out. And I want someone to write in, because the one question I have about this, if you can count cards, why is that illegal? Or it's not illegal, but why does the casino have the right to throw you out?
It is a good question.
I hope someone writes in, because I don't quite understand. If you actually are good enough to count cards, you're playing by the rules.
You're not actually. I mean, the casino, that is cheating, and if you're cheating, they have the right to kick you out.
Why is it cheating? Because they set that rule. What I'm saying is the rule is inane. If you're saying, look, I can hit the ball out of the park, you know, in baseball every single time I'm up. Well, what, you're going to change the rule just because I'm able to do that?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It will be interesting if we have some gambling aficionados out there who want to chime in. You know our email address, feedback@filmspotting.net. From a classic movie standpoint here, a couple of movies I have to confess I haven't seen. I don't know if you have, Maddie, but High and Low, this is a special edition double disc that includes an audio commentary featuring Akira Kurosawa scholar Stephen Prince. This, of course, is a Kurosawa film. It also has a 37-minute documentary on the making of High and Low. So some good stuff there, a rare video interview with the actor Toshiro Mifune. I had that tandem on my top five actor-director duos a couple weeks ago here on the show. So that is out now. Look forward to checking that out. And also Vampire, this is another special edition double disc set. Carl Theodore Dreyer, the great filmmaker. This is a film from 1966, and it has a documentary on it chronicling Dreyer's career and also a visual essay by one of Dreyer's big scholars. So you can check those films out now. I know I will be.
All right. It's time now to thank everyone who found their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. I know we say this every week, but we truly, truly are humbled by each and every donation that we get, and it goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. Thank you this week, Platinum, another Platinum donor, Keith from Ontario, California.
Correct.
Which I believe is outside LA. I think there's an airport there. Silver Club donation from Rich from Ealing, London.
Another Ealing.
It's the second donation we've gotten from Ealing. Thank you so much. Peggy in Readyville, Tennessee. I'm sure it's beautiful Readyville, Tennessee. And Nathan in Earlsfield, London.
I actually think, Maddie, that Londoners are single-handedly financing this show right now. They're keeping us on the air.
Yeah, exactly. And I also want to point out, you know, we always say we're so huge in Melbourne. Well, we got a bunch of emails this week
inviting us down.
I think it's Melbourne is how you actually pronounce
Nicely
it.
Nicely done.
And I think their film festival actually starts up at the end of July. I think next year we need
forget
to get down
Sundance,
there.
Forget Sundance. Toronto,
right.
We're heading to Melbourne.
Exactly.
Okay.
So donate in order to send us to the land down under.
There you go. And also, we really do, again, we do appreciate every single donation, but a huge donation there from Keith in Ontario, the Platinum Club donation. He had actually gone back and listened to all of our catalog of shows after discovering the show recently.
Oh, why?
One of many people
who actually write in and say
they do that. I don't know. You haven't even gone back and listened to the old shows, Maddie. So we really do appreciate that and all of the donations. Good stuff.
And do remember that for every $10 that you donate, your name is entered into the well-worn film spotting hat. And at the end of the month, we pick a name and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. And I think we can say that Film Spotting After Hours is going to happen
next week.
If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab at the top of the page.
Just going to disintegrate in a novel way with that. And then I'll die. And then it'll be over.
No, no, no. I don't accept that. There must be something we can do. You know, somebody we can go to, a test that can be done.
No! I won't be just another tumorous bore talking endlessly about his hair falling out and his lost lymph nodes.
Well, then what do you want me to do? Why did you call me?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie. That's Adam. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show wherein Adam and I absolutely massacre, obliterate, wouldn't you say, leave for dead a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard between, of course, Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis in the classic remake of the classic The Fly.
Yeah, a great fun scene to play there. Your Jeff Goldblum was very good. A lot of good comments, positive comments from listeners this week who disagreed with me that it was too much Woody Allen. They thought you, for the most part, everyone seemed to think you nailed Jeff Goldblum. And it reminds me of the one listener, Maddie, who made the comment about the David Duchovny impression of Goldblum that was on Saturday Night Live a few years back during a Jeopardy scene. I know you're an SNL guy. Do you remember that?
I don't, actually.
I looked for it on YouTube and I couldn't find it because I would love to play it. It's absolutely hysterical.
All right. Well, why don't you reach into that film spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
And the winner is Dan Cron from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
All right. Up there, Western Canada.
That's right. We love to say Saskatoon. Congratulations, Dan. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I'll say action, Eddie. That'll be your cue, right? You come through the door. You walk right over here to the desk, to Amber, and we shoot.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and I really don't think we need to say a whole lot here by way of a hint. It should be fairly obvious, though maybe somewhat of a difficult scene we will see here as we get the responses. And too bad most of you weren't in the room here earlier. You would have heard a nice little spat during our little production meeting where we were trying to figure out who was going to play which part here, because one is definitely more fun than the other. I had capitulated to you, Maddie. Now you're giving it back to me. Is that right?
Bring it. Bring it, Kempinar.
Now there's all this pressure. I have to prove that I deserve to play this part, and I'm absolutely going to butcher it. But that's what Massacre Theater is all about, right?
Exactly.
Okay, I start it then. You give me the action.
And action.
Mr. Blank, have you considered the cost of such a machine?
Price is not an object.
Perhaps not, but have you considered the cost?
I'm not sure I follow.
Go home. Forget this thing. I can recognize an obsession. No good will come of it.
Why? Hasn't good come of your obsessions?
Well, at first, but I followed them too long. I'm their slave, and one day they will choose to destroy me.
If you understand an obsession, then you know you won't change my mind.
End scene.
I love it. We're sort of doing dueling takes on a character at different times in his career.
That's true.
Wow, the nuance, the level, the depths you get here on Film Spotter.
During Massacre Theater, absolutely. Well, if you know what film we really did just massacre, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net. You have until Wednesday, July 23rd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
I want to talk to you somewhere outside of here. Maybe we could have a coffee or something.
I can't have coffee. It's on the bad food list you gave me. What kind of doctor are you?
Well, you don't have to have coffee. You could have water or fruit juice.
That's a bad idea.
You know, people are always saying you got to get right with Jesus if you want not to go to hell. You know, you got to say you're sorry and Jesus will let you into heaven.
You can put it that way.
A montage there of female performances from last July when we did this show. Actually, Maddie, you weren't here, but our guest was, and our guest is Steve Procopi. You might know him better as Capone from Ain't It Cool News. Steve, it is great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me back.
And when we did this list last time, you heard some of those performances there. Julie Christie, Christina Ricci, who we both really liked in Black Snake Moan.
Sure.
Carrie Russell, I liked in Waitress a lot, in Taboo from The Namesake, another one that stuck out from last year at this point. And I noticed when I was putting together my list this year, I had a lot of trouble, whereas last year we already had some of those great performances here at the halfway point of the year, or just past the halfway point. Did you have similar trouble this year? How does this year so far compare to last year in terms of the female performances?
I felt really bad for females this year. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the studios or just last year I came up with four without even thinking about it. And this year I really had to dive in a little more to some of the smaller films that I've seen mm-hmm. in the first 6 months. And just once I did that, it sort of opened up the gates for me to really find some prime people that probably won't be remembered by the end of the year, but at least hopefully recognizing them this early in the year will get people to see these movies.
Definitely. Well, what's your number five?
Number five, actually, the one that a lot of people probably did see, probably the biggest movie on this list is Mila Kunis from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I always try to save the number five spot in both categories for a discovery of mine, someone who's maybe been around for a while, but I've never really noticed.
And yeah.
I'd never seen, I certainly knew her from That 70s Show, but I'd never seen the show. She was so charming and so pretty and so engaging. And, you know, some people said Kristen Bell was the one who would be in this category, but I did not think so. She is the one that I wanted to date after seeing that movie, too. So,
well, that's a great pick. And actually, I'm going to bite my tongue a little bit. I don't know if Maddie needs to as well, but let's go ahead and hear your number five, Maddie.
Well, my number five is Katinka Untaru mm-hmm. from The Fall. And, I really had to convince myself to include her on here. But if I'm going to be honest, she's just so natural. How the hell do you not include her? I mean, there's one scene towards the end where Lee Pace actually asks, "Are you trying to save my soul?" And I think it actually played in the trailer as well. And there's a pause there. And obviously they're improvising. And then she just smiles in response. And you can't get that. You can't get that from an actor. She's obviously just so invested in that moment. Sure, it helps to be a kid. Probably 10 years from now, when she has all that sort of adolescent, you know, inhibitions again and self-conscious stuff, she won't be able to match that. But I got to put her on here because she is that good.
Can I just add?
Yeah.
I did not put her on my list, and I probably should have. The reason that she smiles in that scene is because she doesn't know what the word soul means. And
exactly.
She's pretending that she does. And I've had a three-hour conversation with Tarsem, the director of that, and we spent an hour of it just talking about her.
Really?
And about finding her and about how he worked with her. And that's a remarkable achievement in filmmaking mm-hmm. this year that deserves to be in like a separate category from every other movie I've ever seen in
right.
my life. And she is glorious in that. She's not on my list, but
maybe
she probably should
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
She's number zero on my list. She's above one. Yeah.
I got you. Well, I also want to add before I get to my number five that we aren't counting, or at least I'm not counting 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days in this list. I think we're counting that as a 2007 film, even though we didn't review it until February here. But Anna Maria Marinka, the actress there, of course, brilliant in that movie. But again, a 2007 performance. For me, again, I had a really hard time putting together this list, and I feel like in terms of my 4 and 5 choices, I kind of just gave it to them by default because they had to do so much heavy lifting in their roles. And my number 5 is Kate Beckinsale from Snow Angels, the David Gordon Green film. And she plays the mother of a young girl, and she's the ex-wife to a very disturbed Sam Rockwell in that film. And I don't want to get into the reasons why she has to do so much heavy lifting and bust out the waterworks, but she's just really effective and subtle and really believable as a small-town woman kind of going nowhere, you know, despite the fact that Kate Beckinsale is also kind of the starlet in many ways. I think she really pulls it off, and it is kind of one of those performances where she kind of uglies herself a little bit. I almost feel bad praising it in that way, but I think she's really good here.
She does. She actually did a very convincing job of playing the best-looking woman in a small town.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, and works at a Chinese restaurant. And
it's,
yeah,
it's 100% without a doubt the best thing she has ever done.
Sure.
I mean, period. And she was on my short list but didn't make the 5.
Okay, well, who made your number 4?
This is actually for 2 roles that I've seen her in this year. Technically, one of these might be 2007, but I saw them both this year, and that's Aja Argento in Last Mistress and in another film called Boarding Gate.
Okay.
They're insane roles. I could also throw in
Mother of Tears.
Mother of Tears, yeah, without a doubt. Although she lowered herself in the acting to make that, you know, to sort of equal the other actors in the film, but she has really surprised me. I think she's actually become a really great actress in the last couple years. And Alone, maybe not, although Last Mistress is really close. I thought she was excellent in that film. But she plays crazy better than anyone, and I applaud her for that.
Well, I haven't seen any of those films. I know Maddie had the Mother of Tears experience in Toronto. I don't know if you want to weigh in on that.
I love how she lowered herself to make her other cast look good. That's a neat trick. I don't know about that.
It's a mark of a brilliant actress. You adapt.
All right, well, my number 4, already been mentioned, Mila Kunis. Not only is she just drop-dead Lauren Bacall gorgeous here, but she's so, so natural. You're absolutely right. She's the girl next door, the girl you want to try and court. I would love to see her. I'm going to put this forward here. I'd love to see her in a Woody Allen film. That's how good I actually thought
she
was.
I would too. Instead of Scarlett Johansson, that would be
exactly.
Really great to see. Well, my number 4, again, you talk about heavy lifting. This is your go-to actress, and you mentioned, you know, that Aja Argento plays crazy better than anyone else. I don't know that any other actress plays disturbed and tortured any better than this actress, and that's Naomi Watts from Funny Games, perennially one of my favorite actresses, and I'm not sure any character had to suffer more on screen this year than her, quite literally, totally degraded as that character. And again, I think she's kind of your go-to actress for parts like this, but there really is, for me, something brave about her willingness to play those difficult, tortured, ugly parts like that in Funny Games. So not one of the big reasons why I like that movie, her performance, but nevertheless a very solid, good performance. So Naomi Watts is my number 4.
Definitely something torture going on in that theater. I'm not sure it was just her, though. A little bit of me, too.
Oh, no. You weren't a big Funny Games guy?
I am a huge fan of the original, and the remake, the necessity of it outweighed any like I might have had for the actors.
Well, this is a discussion for another time. Yeah. Your number 3, Steve.
My number 3 is, this is another double nomination of sort, and you mentioned Snow Angels before, Olivia Thirby in that and The Whackness. Mm-hmm. I think it between those two films and Juno, we have seen a range of someone that could have very easily just played a very typical sort of teen roles for the next 10 years if she wanted to. And she is exceptional, and Snow Angels is probably the better of those two films. And,
no question.
Yeah, but I mean her performance as well. But yes. I liked her a great deal in each, and again, a different kind of sweetness than Mila, but still completely dateable.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to put it.
That makes a difference to male critics.
Can you tell that there are 3 guys in the room? Yeah. Our apologies to all our female listeners. But actually, I really liked Olivia Thirlby as well in that film, and I think my hatred for The Whackness actually made me bump her off the list. But I did really like her in Snow Angels, so a great pick there. Maddie, your number 3.
All right, number 3 gives me another opportunity to butcher a name. Denai Jekesai Gurira from The Visitor. She has to play helpless in this film, and that's really, really hard to do, and it's even harder to do when you can't really fight to get him back, which is what she's tasked with here. The script doesn't allow her these sort of big emotional, you know, give me back my son moments I thought it was actually a really very human, very touching performance, along with Chaim Abbas as the mother as well there in that film.
Yeah, no, very good. I agree. Good choices there. Kind of obscure with The Visitor. I wonder if Richard Jenkins may show up here later. I'm hoping he does on one of our lists, and we'll see what happens. But for me right now, my number three, she's been praised a lot already, but why don't we go ahead and hear a scene anyway?
I'm sorry, I just don't want to complicate things.
Oh, no, of course.
Yeah?
Oh, no, totally. I totally get that. I had a great time.
Handshake.
Well, the trifecta there for Mila Kunis from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And you mentioned Lauren Bacall earlier, which you also mentioned on the show when we reviewed it. And I loved that because I saw a lot of Lauren Bacall in her as well. And that prompted one of our listeners, Enrique Gomez in Elgin, Texas, to write in and say, first 2 weeks ago, we compared Mila Kunis' performance in Sarah Marshall to Lauren Bacall. And then the show today, at the time, you were talking about Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow having a Nick and Nora Charles thing going on in Iron Man. You cannot be serious, Enrique writes. You two are rapidly killing my faith in your perspective on individual performances. And then I wrote him back and said, well, have you seen the movie yet? Because there really is a Bacall quality to her, physically and also just in the way she acts on screen. And he wrote back and said, while I'll be the first person to admit she's pretty and much more charismatic physically than Kristen Bell, she doesn't have a fraction of Bacall's charisma, class, charm, or wit. And I gotta say, I hear what you're saying, Enrique.
You're completely wrong.
And I understand putting Bacall on this great pedestal. At some point, we all have to revere these great icons of cinema. But I also think that's just being very short-sighted in some ways. I mean, I know she was on That 70 Show, and Lauren Bacall is this icon, but that doesn't mean Mila Kunis could not evolve into that screen icon someday. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I disagree. I think she has all the charisma and class and charm, and maybe it was just Howard Hawks who made Bacall look so good. Who knows? So I'm going with Mila Kunis there as my number
three. She'd probably look very good in black and white, too.
Yeah, so. I think she would. I could see her in The Big Sleep. Why not? So why don't we hear your number two then, Steve?
Number two is Amy Adams in Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day. One of the funniest things I've seen all year, and a sort of old-fashioned slapstick kind of comedy. And since we're throwing out icons' names, I'll throw out Marilyn Monroe as being clearly the role model for Amy Adams in this movie. But it's, I don't know why it didn't do better. I know a lot of people that saw it, but it never really seemed to catch on the way some of those independent films do sometimes. So let me just throw it out there and make sure people catch it on DVD.
Well, Amy Adams is a really talented actress, and we didn't help that movie's cause any. No. We skipped it completely here on the show.
We've actually had a lot of listeners actually write in, though, and suggest it. I think it's out on DVD now.
I think
it just came out.
Yeah, maybe just came out. So now we can check out what we're missing with Amy Adams' performance there. Maddie, your number two.
Well, my number two, she's already been mentioned, Naomi Watts in Funny Games. I mean, of course, Michael Haneke, we could get into how arrogant he's trying to be here and trying to sort of bore you and teach you a lesson. Well, if you're trying to teach me a lesson, don't get Naomi Watts to be the one that's tortured, because I find that absolutely fascinating. So, of course, I'm not going to look away because I want to watch her, you know, whether she's being tortured, whatever she's doing, reading the phone book, of course. So I think she's great in that film.
Yeah, absolutely. Good pick there. For me, my number two, and you mentioned Marilyn Monroe a second ago, another Marilyn Monroe. My top two choices here are actually movies I liked, but I certainly didn't love. But the biggest reason I did like them was the performance of the lead actress, and that's Samantha Morton in Mr. Lonely, the Harmony Korine film. And I remember thinking last year that it was odd that a 30-year-old Morton was playing the 18-year-old wife to Ian Curtis in Control, but she pulled that off somehow. And then this year, she would never make my top 10 list of women I would expect to play Marilyn Monroe, and yet here she is playing Marilyn Monroe. She's playing a Marilyn Monroe impersonator in this movie, and she's absolutely the heart and soul of the film, and she kind of broke my heart watching her, really. I mean, she was, for me, the most fascinating reason, the biggest reason to check out that movie. So she's my number two.
Oh, she's great, and I'm actually a huge supporter of that film. I think Diego Luna is remarkable.
Oh, he's good.
Yeah. And
Werner Herzog having some fun.
Yes, Werner. Werner getting more on-screen time than usual these days.
True.
I'm happy to see all of them do their thing. But there's really nothing Samantha Morton can't do at this point. So.
I agree. She's proved it the last couple of years anyway, for sure. So here we are now, finally, number one, our favorite female performances of the year. Steve, your number one.
The name came up peripherally, but Chaim Abbas from The Visitor is my number one. There, in addition to just being that sort of grieving mother, I guess that's the best way to put it, even though the son's not dead, but she may never see him again. I like the non-romance, the almost mm-hmm. anti-romance going on between her and Richard Jenkins. She's polite with him, possibly falling for him, or possibly there's things going on behind her eyes, and you're right. not always sure what her motivation is for being subjected to whatever it is he's, you know, him wanting to date her. And we know there's no possibility that it can be a future between them, but it's and she was the heartbreaking performance for me of this year.
Okay. So. It is a great pick. She was really fantastic in that film. Maddie, number one for you.
You stole it.
Really?
You stole my number one.
Samantha Morton?
Samantha Morton.
Whoa.
She's unbelievable in that film. I wasn't actually that familiar with her work before I saw her in Control. I thought she was fantastic in that. I mean, just the empathy she's able to evoke in every single role I see her in, it's astonishing.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to see it that high. I thought you might forget her. I'm glad to see that you didn't. Well, I ruined your number one. You ruined my number one, actually, with your number five. She is my number one. I'm giving it to Cătinca Întaru, the Romanian actress who is 11 now, I believe, but 7 at the time she was in The Fall. And you just did it again. We both gushed at the time we reviewed it about how authentic her performance was. There's just really nothing artificial about it at all. It
I mean,
was like
so
she's taking
in
it
that
in.
Way.
Yeah, you're right. She was really taking the story in for the first time. And we got an email from Alex, a director. He wrote in and said that there's an interview with Tarsem, and you obviously can really weigh in on this, Steve, but he said there was an interview on HollywoodPreviews.com where Tarsem explained that he basically tricked her into thinking she was actually being told stories by a guy with a broken leg. I wasn't able to find that interview. To be honest, that part of it sounds a little bit goofy to me. She knew she was making a film.
No,
I think that's very obvious.
It's 100% true. She did know she was making a film. It wasn't just that Tarsem convinced her that he was did not have the use of the legs. Every single person on that movie thought he was someone who had who was paralyzed from the waist down, because this was made years ago before anybody knew who he was, before he had been on any TV shows or in any movies, and they passed him off as a handicapped person, and they all bought it until the last day of shooting when they revealed it. And
got it.
So you have to give, I don't know if Lee Pace's name is going to come up later, but you have to give him credit for her performance too, because mm-hmm. most of the film he's guiding her mm-hmm. through their conversations. And not only that, but he's moving his body to light her, because I mean, they did so much of it with sort of just a camera through a sheet, and it is a performance I could watch 100 times and always see something different.
Definitely.
So, all credit to Tarsem for taking that kind of risk.
Yeah. I think the way I read Alex's email originally was that he was suggesting almost that the whole thing was this big ruse. Like, she really didn't know what she was involved in. And really, the fact is, it's all on the screen. I mean, her authenticity, as we've mm-hmm. said now, the genuine quality she brings to that. I mean, you can see that clearly. I didn't know all the backstory that you've just given me. Clearly, Tarsem had some tricks up his sleeve, though, because you see it in the performance. It's all there on the screen. She's just amazing to watch.
Well, Mr. Campanaro, any honorable mentions?
I actually didn't have any honorable mentions. It was so hard for me to squeeze five out, unfortunately. And I'll blame Hollywood, not myself, for that. The dearth of good female performances this year. That's all I really had.
Mr. Capone?
Yeah. The only two that I wrote down that did not make my list, and you mentioned Gwyneth Paltrow before. She was close. But again, I expect her to be good. It's one of the better things I've seen her do lately.
Yeah.
So I'll give her, she was probably just below the five. And a movie I didn't like that much, but I thought Julianne Moore in Savage Grace was really, really strong.
Yeah, that movie's just so crazy, and I loathed it so much that I couldn't give her any credit there.
Well,
you
stole one of my names here, Julianne Moore from Savage Grace. She is great in that, my God. Kristen Davis from Sex and the City, Amy Poehler from Baby Mama, and Victoria Vinga from the Norwegian film Reprise.
Well, I'm glad to see that you were able to squeeze out a few more names there. Reprise, one of the films that I most regret I haven't seen. I know a lot of people were big fans of it this year. Well, we're going to take one last quick break. When we come back, who will drink from Film Spotting's milkshake this year? Stay with us as we count down our top five male performances of the year so far.
I watched the old man dream of how it used to be. He plowed the open fields, he fished the clear blue stream.
Contest time here on Film Spotting. We want to give away some prizes in our recent Take the Red Pill Recast the Matrix contest. The controversial Recast the Matrix contest. Maddie has wanted no part of this. Why would you want to recast the immortal Keanu Reeves as Neo? But yet many listeners dared to do it, and we got some great responses here, including our grand prize winner, Jay Damer 83. Maddie, take it away.
All right. Enter the Matrix, a late 60s, early 70s extravaganza. All right. Already, I got to say, he's on the right track, yeah, or she's on the right track here. In a parallel universe, the Wachowski brothers are born 25 years earlier, which makes their period of success overlap the 60s and 70s. After the success of The Bound, 1968, a Godard-inspired heist movie that they wrote, which has an interesting, if not peculiar, lesbian subtext, the Wachowskis shop around their latest script, Enter the Matrix, a sci-fi action-adventure film that's way ahead of its time.
Most studios pass on it, except for the struggling Paramount Studios, which, like in our universe, is run by an inexperienced Robert Evans. Knowing that Enter the Matrix has characters who know kung fu and that the movie will need foreign capital in order to be properly budgeted, Evans makes an investment deal with the Shaw Organization in Hong Kong. A part of the deal includes a stipulation that states that the production of Enter the Matrix have access to the talent at the Shaw Brothers studio, which Evans and Francis Ford Coppola, who has also gotten involved in this project, take full advantage of for purposes of the movie's many fight scenes. Also, in need of a special effects artist, Evans hires Douglas Trumbull, who has just come off of Stanley Kubrick's production of Childhood End. Evans and Coppola get to work casting the movie. When the cast is put in place, they find it's a good mixture of big names with big talent. First off, as Neo, and remember, this is when, the late 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm, Clint Eastwood, a no-brainer. Eastwood is one of the biggest stars in the world, and his stoic, otherworldly nature perfectly suits the character. Because of a fear that he will look ridiculous doing kung fu, Eastwood is initially reluctant to take the role, but he accepts after Evans personally offers to buy a house for him.
James Earl Jones as Morpheus, an iffy choice for Evans, who initially wanted the more well-known Sidney Poitier. Yet Coppola fought for Jones in the role, and after seeing him say the alphabet on Sesame Street, Evans admits that Jones is perfect for the role. Julie Christie as Trinity.
I can't wait to see this movie.
Cool, beautiful, and ethereal, Christie fits the role of Trinity like a glove. George C. Scott as Agent Smith, because the man can play villains so well, and he looks like the possible devil incarnate. Scott is offered the role. He accepts, but doesn't want his name in the credits. I love that little added touch. And the rest of the cast, Ruby Dee, of course, as the Oracle, Telly Savalas as Cypher, Ernest Borgnine as Tank, John Cazale as Apoc.
You love that.
Oh, I love it. Tom Courtney as Mouse, Sandy Dennis as Switch, Jim Brown as Dozer, of course, Dennis Hopper, pre-Easy Ryder as Agent Brown, and Dean Stockwell as Agent Jones.
Good stuff. I can see Dean Stockwell in that role. And here's the coda on this. Despite being a troubled production that included Richard Lester being hired for the action scenes, Enter the Matrix is released in December of 1971. The movie becomes a huge success, beating out the Poseidon Adventure at the box office on the same weekend. Evans saves Paramount Studio with the profits from the film, but he unfortunately spends his entire income for the year on his cocaine habit. The end, Jay Damer 83. And I'm pretty sure that's our buddy John Damer
from San Francisco
Bay Area. So congratulations to John. He's going to get some swanky American Apparel Spout swag. I'm not sure the prize is worth, no offense to Spout or American Apparel, I'm not sure if it's worth the amazing amount of work he put into crafting that recasting.
I love our listeners.
I know.
Love
some great
listeners.
Stuff. And I quickly want to note here, Maddie, Tom Courtney as Mouse. We're going to see Tom Courtney at least once, I think twice, in our upcoming Angry Young Men marathon. We are doing the British New Wave marathon after we get done with the heist movies marathon. So look forward to that. And we also have a runner-up winner here, Wade Town, and I love this one too, Maddie. The BBC presents The Matrix.
Clive Owen as Neo. When you think about it, this would be a lot like his role in Children of Men, a disillusioned character, frustrated with his reality, except with a lot less baby protecting and a lot more kung fu. But, you know, the thing is Clive Owen, he just knows too much. He just, you know, I don't know if he's that naive, but we'll see. Sir Ben Kingsley as Morpheus. Morpheus has to be bald, of course. Cate Blanchett as Trinity. She can wear her wig from Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Alan Rickman as Agent Smith. This pick hinges on the availability of using a time machine to go back and get the Hans Gruber Alan Rickman from Die Hard. Dame Judi Dench as the Oracle. Small role for her, but since it's Judi Dench, she'll probably get nominated for an Oscar.
I really like Patty Considine as Cypher. Something about Patty Considine screams for a role as a double-crossing weasel. I agree. Chiwetel Ejiofor as Tank. Not much reasoning behind this pick other than the Zion-born human should be healthy and attractive. Steve Coogan as Apoc, bringing much-needed comic comic relief to the movie, Freddie Highmore as Mouse, his first adult role, and I really want to see him whip out two huge machine guns right before his character gets killed.
I dig it.
Tandy Newton as Switch, Colin Salmon as Dozer. I don't know who that is. My only obscure selection, Wade Town writes, he was in a couple of the Pierce Brosnan Bond films, I believe. Plus, he kind of looks like Chiwetel Ejiofor's brother. Jeremy Irons as Agent Brown, another diehard villain as an agent, and Hugh Laurie as Agent Jones. For some reason, all my agents ended up being the snide, sarcastic Brits. That works for me. They work well as villains, don't they, Maddie?
Great picks.
So congratulations again to JDamer83 and to Wade Town. Wade Town's actually going to get a copy of Batman the Movie, the Blu-ray disc from 1966. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will get that prize out to you. And we got another great contest coming up this week. I think this one's going to be the most entered film gaming spout contest yet. We are asking you, in honor of Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker in the new Batman, spout his pick what they think is the most difficult recasting game they could think of, recasting Reservoir Dogs. Switching out Keitel or Buscemi is like putting on a new pair of shoes that are filled with swamp water. I don't even know exactly what that means, but the point is it would feel really wrong, and I agree with our friends at Spout, but you can try it. You can recast Reservoir Dogs at filmgaming.spout.com. I can't wait to see who gets QT's role. He was Mr. Brown, wasn't
he? Yeah, exactly. You know, I know this is going to sound like sacrilege to a lot of our listeners, but the fact of the matter is there are performances in that movie, and I would count QT's performance in there as well, that can be improved upon.
Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing it. Again, you can enter at filmgaming.spout.com. We certainly encourage you to do so. The grand prize winner is going to get a copy of the new graphic novel adaptation of M, by John J. Muth. Maddie, as you know,
who wrote the foreword
for which
that?
I wrote the foreword.
Oh,
I'll even sign it if people actually want me to sign it.
Whose signature are you going to sign?
That's a good question.
Which one do you know?
Yeah. So you're going to get that. It's a really great edition of the book. John J. Muth is a fantastic artist, did a great job. So I look forward to sending that out to a lucky winner. And then a runner-up is going to get a $10 gift certificate to the Spout store and a T-shirt. So again, please go to filmgaming.spout.com.
Watch the old man dream, it makes me think love is real.
I can't even see what the point is. We can't be certain this is what it is. You're far too young.
You ain't got but one life. You ought to live it the way you want.
Why are you in this war against us?
I never wanted to go to war. I only wanted to fly.
You should sign this.
I love America. America gave me wings. I will not sign it. Absolutely not.
What are you? Don't look at me. I mean, we can talk about our fears here. I mean, yeah. I mean, honestly, like if Doc Brown screeched up in front of you in the DeLorean, open the doors like, hey, Allison.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie and our guest Steve Procopi from Ain't It Cool News this week. We're counting down our favorite performances of the year. You just heard us give our favorite female performances. Now it's time for the males, and actually, there was a montage there of some of the picks from last year, Steve, when you sat in last July with us. Gordon Pinsett from Away From Her. We had Samuel L. Jackson from Black Snake Moan. Christian Bale was on your list from Rescue Dawn. And also Seth Rogen, actually, at the time from Knocked Up, your favorite male performance of the year. So
wow. Was it really number one?
That was really your number wow. one at the time. We'll see how this year's list stacks up. Who was your number five?
Not surprisingly, my other discovery, Jason Segel from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. That's sort of my discovery slot, like Mila Kunis. I was a little more familiar with because I'd seen Freaks and Geeks, and I loved him in Knocked Up. But there's, again, just natural, charming, obviously musically gifted. Mm-hmm. And he's willing to, you know, do the full Monty. So,
yes, he is. That's got to be worth something, right?
To somebody.
You know, number five slot there on your list. Maddie, what about you?
Number five, I don't know why I torture myself with these names, but I'm going with David Streisau from The Counterfeiters, which, of course, won Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film last year. Oddly enough, the parts of this film that take place in the concentration camp, not that evocative for me. But every time that Streisau comes on, he plays Sturmbannführer Frederick Herzog, and he plays him as this sort of country club cashmere-wearing ineffectual, sort of Nazi as middle manager, which I think we can all kind of relate to. And it puts you in that weird position where you actually are longing for him to come back onto the screen so you can spend more time with the Nazi. But I thought he was terrific.
Well, another movie that I need to check out. My number five, a lot less obscure than that one. It is Robert Downey Jr. from Iron Man, and I know we all saw Hulk, and of course, Iron Man, Tony Stark, shows up at the end of that film, and the theater applauded when he comes on the screen. And I don't think it was just that it was Iron Man and it was this great geek crossover moment, but I think we've all just decided that Robert Downey Jr. is that damn likable and that much fun to watch. And he did bring a lot of depth and humor to that Tony Stark character that I think few actors could have brought to it. So he is my number five. Maybe kind of an obvious choice, but I did really like him, and he gets the number five slot. So what about you, Steve, on your number four?
I've seen his next movie already, and you might have him on your list twice by the end of the year.
Okay.
My number four is, since we're going to jump on the Snow Angels love train a little more, Sam Rockwell from Snow Angels. Talk about playing crazy well. Yeah, he might be the king right now, I think. So I will say not much more about what he does in the movie, but he's all over the place, but it's very controlled and always scary.
Yeah.
And one of the scariest things I've seen this year.
Very well put. A great choice there.
Well, I'm going with Robert Downey Jr. too, but I'm going with his performance as Principal Nathan Gardner in Charlie Bartlett, which I thought was the saving grace of that film, which otherwise I thought was pretty all over the place. But here, he actually gets to be a little bit deeper, a little bit darker. That's what I wanted from Tony Stark, and instead I just sort of got the fun-loving playboy. I think those overtones are going to come out a little bit more in sequels, I'm assuming. But I actually really liked him in that film.
A movie I liked more than you, and I did really like him as well in that movie. Well, for me, he could definitely be higher. I think a lot of people may be wondering why he isn't higher. Maybe even someone in this room will have to see as this list goes on. But for me, number four is Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight as the Joker. And, you know, we already reviewed the movie and talked a lot about his performance in the film. But he did really surprise me with just how scary and fascinating he was to watch. So for a great villain performance, that's at least worth a number four slot here on my list. Steve, you're number three.
Brendan Gleeson in Bruges. And I feel bad singling him out because there are three excellent male performances in that movie that are probably all worth mentioning. But I think his is just a little bit better. We get a little more of that sort of seasoned guy in him. And that, you know, that being said, it's also probably the best thing Colin Farrell's ever done. And,
yeah,
and Ralph Fiennes is a great villain.
He's fun to watch.
So That might be my favorite movie of the year so far. So without a doubt, Brendan Gleeson.
A great pick. Maddie?
Well, my number three is, of course, Richard Jenkins from Visitor. You were wondering if he was going to come up. I thought he was great in North Country a couple years back, and I'm so glad now that he's finally getting these starring roles. It must be so much fun to be an actor in Tom McCarthy films, because, again, it's character portraiture. It's not plot-driven. It just has to be so much fun to do that. And of course, it all stems from the fact that McCarthy himself is an actor. A lot of people would recognize him from The Wire.
And sure.
Is there anything they can't do?
Yeah, really, exactly.
At the end of the day.
Well, the overlapping is going to continue here with my number three in terms of our list, because I have Sam Rockwell from Snow Angels as well. And I think David Gordon Green in that movie does put him in a lot of really melodramatic moments, and I'm not sure that they all quite work, but I don't think he really ever takes the bait. I actually think he keeps it pretty subtle, and I think there's a lot of shades to that character of Glenn, who trouble doesn't begin to describe him. I think deranged is more like it, and even when he's going completely off the rails near the end of the film, or really the last half of the film, Rockwell nailed it. He had me empathizing with him the whole way, and I think it obviously takes a really talented actor to do that. So that is my number three.
And I'm hearing he's very good in Choke as well. I don't know if either of you guys saw it at Sundance, but I can't wait to see that. I have a feeling that might land up somewhere at the end of the year list.
He's very good in Choke. I actually did catch it at Sundance, though. It was the last film I saw there, and due to other circumstances, I actually had to leave for the last, I missed the last half hour, so I can't claim that I've seen Choke, but I did see most of Rockwell's performance, which brings us to our number two slot, Steve.
Richard Jenkins, The Visitor. You're absolutely right. Tom McCarthy is one of my favorite interviews that I've done this year, and he just loved talking about all the things that Richard Jenkins had done, and most people don't even remember him in. Probably the first time I remembered his name was with 6 Feet Under.
Me too. Right.
But he had been acting in theater and movies and TV for years before that, and it's just great that he gives these people, he's kind of discovered a lot of lesser known people who have pretty much been working steady since he put them in the
Bobby Cannavale and Station Agent.
Love him.
Who's the busiest man in show business, right?
Right.
I will see your Brendan Gleeson, and I will raise you Colin Farrell. I think he is
absolutely the perfect vessel to spew Martin McDonagh's absolutely joyously offensive lines. And it all stems from this ignorance. We have to believe that he's that well-meaning while at the same time that dumb and that racist. And when he says, with such excitement, they're filming midgets. It's so disturbing. You can't help yourself from chuckling, but at the same time, you've got to admonish yourself for chuckling, and that, I mean, you have to sell it, and he does.
Yeah, he definitely does. My number two is Chiwetel Ejiofor from the David Mamet movie Red Belt. I think he was
not
the
Ricky
best.
Jay?
No, not Ricky Jay, unfortunately, but I really think it takes a confident, pure talent, which I think he is, to not go for being cool, and we talked about that. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to play that role as just kind of reveling and being a badass and trying to be really cool and macho, and he doesn't. He just plays the part. He just says his lines. He really is a consummate Mamet actor, I think, in a lot of ways. He's a pure professional, and I think the fact that he's in almost every scene of that movie compensates for a lot of the other problems otherwise with that film. I love him as an actor in just about everything, and this really was a great vehicle for him, I think, in Red Belt. So Ejiofor, my number two. We're here now at the number one slot. Steve?
Heath Ledger, Dark Knight. Hmm. Not only did I find no fault with the performance, but it's probably the best screen villain I've seen in at least 20 years. We talked about playing crazy. That's not exactly what he's doing here in any kind of traditional, recognizable mm-hmm. way. And I know you guys talked about this a lot already, but it's scary, but it's also really smart, the character and his performance. Everyone will go see it this weekend and know exactly what I'm talking about. And I told everyone, you may think you know how good he is going to be just from the little clips you've seen, but you have no idea.
Hmm.
And as much as I hate to agree with Richard Roper, he probably is an absolute lock for a supporting actor win, I think.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
I'm really worried about Mr. Roper's health. He is in a conniption fit about this. Yeah. I mean, he is working himself into such a lather. I'm really sort of worried about him.
Well, who should he be looking at instead with your number one pick, Matt?
Well, don't get me wrong. I love Mr. Ledger, as we talked about. Well, but my number one belongs to Francois Clouzet from the French film Tell No One.
You saw this?
Yeah.
Without me?
Yeah, I know. You haven't seen it, and you need to go see it. He reminds me a lot of Dustin Hoffman here. The movie overall, it's an effective thriller. It's a lot of fun. It's not great, but he really shines in a demanding role. He loses his wife in the first 3 minutes, only discover 8 years later that she may still be alive. He gets framed for a murder, and then, of course, he spends the better half of the movie on the run. It's like Jimmy Stewart in those Hitchcock films. And I think he's just as good as Mr. Stewart here. He's really great.
Well, I look forward to seeing that performance and the movie. My number one, you guys, you're ruining my number one pick here. You had Brendan Gleeson, Steve, and Maddie, you had Colin Farrell, but you didn't cheat and have them both together like I did. Let's go ahead and hear a clip from In Bruges.
He swears a lot, doesn't he?
We're staying in tonight. Whatever happens.
Except what? Except only one of us needs to stay in? Really?
Which one of us would that be now, Ray? I thought you didn't like Bruce.
I don't like Bruce at all. But I did already say I had a date with a Belgian lady in the Belgian film business, which I did already say about before.
This is my one cheat, and I will confess right now that at the end of the year, if their performances still stack up, and I think at least one of them will, I will only choose one of them at the end of the year. But right now, I can't choose between them. I mean, I really sung the praises of Colin Farrell during our review because it was such a surprise for me. And you've talked about here during this show how, you know, surprises count for something in a way. You know, Brendan Gleeson, I expect great performances from, but Colin Farrell shocked me. Nevertheless, I didn't want to overlook Brendan Gleeson. They really are a pair. I mean, this is a buddy movie in mm-hmm. every sense of the word, which we've seen buddy movies 100 times. It's the morally conflicted assassin movie, which we've seen a million times. It really should feel old hat and not be that exciting, but McDonagh's writing and their performances really make it hilarious, and they're just together a perfect odd couple pairing with Gleeson kind of playing the father figure to this incorrigible son that Colin Farrell plays. I just think they're a gas to watch on screen, and I couldn't split them apart, so they're my number one.
How about Mr. Procopi? Any honorable mentions for you?
We've both been mentioned. Robert Downey Jr. and Chiwetel Ejiofor. Those are my only two honorable mentions. Yeah.
What about you, Maddie?
Well, I've actually got a lot here, and I do want to get them in. Ron Perlman from Hellboy, Seth MacFarlane from Hellboy, Will Poulter as Lee Carter in Son of Rambo, Tadanobu Asano as Tumajin in Mongol, Douglas Silva as Ace in City of Men, Eddie Redmayne from Savage Grace. I think he's really good as the kid there. Aaron Eckhart from as Harvey Dent, and Michael Pitt from Funny Games.
Well, I'll follow that right up. I had Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett from Funny Games. I had Anton Yelchin as Charlie Bartlett. Really liked him there.
Most annoying performance of the year.
He's so good there. Richard Jenkins, of course, in The Visitor, made your list. Probably could have been higher on my list, I'm sure. And also, I can't remember. I meant to write it down, and I'm going to have to put this in the show notes, but there's an actor from The Band's Visit who kind of plays the playboy. And I know that's an 07 film, and you had an 07 film, The Counterfeiters, on there as well. But I'm going to have to look up his name. I'm sorry. I just forgot to write it down. He's brilliant, though. Have you seen The Band's Visit, Steve?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That playboy character. I just think he is so good in that film. And as I said when we talked about it after I saw it at Ebert Fest, it has a scene in it that is one of the most laugh-out-loud, sweetest scenes I've seen in a movie in a long time, and he's a big reason why. So, again, I'm sorry, I will put that name in the notes to this show on filmspotting.net.
Well, those are our top five male and female performances of the year. Please send in your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, of course, The Dark Knight, need we say any more, Mamma Mia, and Space Chimps, which my children are dying to see. Forget Wally. Holden cannot wait to see Space Chimps, so I know where I'll be when that movie opens.
You're not reviewing that today?
No, we're not.
I've seen it.
Is it good?
It's probably Andy Samberg's best role.
Really?
Wow.
Okay. Well, that's
I don't even
something.
Know what that means.
No.
And you're not supposed to.
Well, on next week's show, of course, the X-Files movie is opening next Friday. We can't get to that. We were going to discuss Step Brothers and Mamma Mia, which I do expect at some point we'll have to share some thoughts on here on the show. But we have decided instead, as we said earlier, to devote some more time to The Dark Knight. We think it does deserve it. And people are always writing in, Maddie, and asking for spoiler editions of movies. Well, now you will get it. We're going to really dive in and dissect that movie with Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and maybe another special guest as well. We're also going to bring in our buddy Scott Tobias from the Onion AV Club. He's going to help us count down our top five movies of the year so far.
All right. Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable production assistance and to our great, great, great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. And special thanks to Joe Dassault, Tori Malatia, and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, and to Utah Carol for this week's music. Learn more about the band at utahcarol.com.
Of course, we also want to thank Steve Procopi. Steve, it was great to have you on again. Great insights, as always. You see so many movies, it just makes me sick. But I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Okay, hope to have you on again soon. And actually, tell our listeners where they can find you on the interwebs.
Ain'titcool.com.
Okay, that's all you need to know, as if they didn't already know about Ain't It Cool. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Yes, you're right. He is known for Dr. Zhivago. You know what else he did? Other films. In fact, he might even have been nominated for this.
I'm not correcting you. I'm genuinely asking. O'Toole's the big performance. Like, Premier did their top 100 performances of all time. Peter O'Toole, Lawrence of Arabia, was number one.
Yes. Okay. Peter O'Toole stars as Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay. Just making sure.
Omar Sharif
is in it too?
Makes an appearance.
Okay. I don't think I've ever seen him in a movie. So...
I'm taking away your film critic card.
Yeah, now that we're totally sidetracked.
All right.